Stay tuned for The Cinema Clash, as Maryland-based critics Charlie Jewell and Hannah Buchdahl debate the merits of new releases, from the mainstream movies that Hannah tends to favor to obscure foreign films that Charlie likes to champion. It's free-flowing, unedited conversation with an occasional wine wager. Two very different perspectives, one entertaining podcast. Let the clash begin.
Hello and welcome to the Cinema Clash. I am Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com.
And I'm Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net.
And I have a beer, and I think it could actually match three of the films we're going to talk about tonight. It specifically matches one the best, but I think it does match like three of them.
And I think, so it's a beer called History Repeating, and who's it from? Kushwa?
Kushwa Brewing Company. It says they are from Williamsport, Maryland. I thought Williamsport was in Pennsylvania, but apparently Maryland has one too.
I guess there are a lot of Williamsports out there, but it's a fine little beer. Is it an ale? It's sort of a...
It says it's a dry-hopped pilsner.
Oh, a pilsner. All right. Well, History Repeating could possibly help us with one of the biggest films of the week, The Last Duel, perhaps?
Actually, no. That was not one I was... connecting with. Because, I think it could have gone with Bergman Island, where they go to Ingmar Bergman's island, where their relationship somewhat mimics a Bergman film. It could have done the a musical documentary I'm going to talk about, where, you know, get the band together, make some hits, break up, as all bands do.
Sounds history like repeating. The Velvet Underground.
But perhaps? No, actually, I was going to relate it to Halloween Kills.
Well, that is history.
Boy,
repeating.
Repeat yourself so, much.
Yeah. Whereas I was thinking history more in terms of like historical epic, which is The Last Duel, which is sort of a 14th century Me Too story. So I thought history repeating, you've got this Me Too narrative going on in recent history. And this,
I see what
last
you're saying.
Duel.
Now, I wasn't, you know, I'm getting older, but I actually wasn't around in the 14th century. And but from what I know of it, and I don't know a lot about what was going on in the 14th century, I highly doubt there was a lot of hashtag Me Too. Now, maybe there was, maybe I'm just ignorant about that, but I don't think there was. But what I do know is that there are three A-list actors in this film, The Last Duel.
Yes. And they are Matt Damon, Adam Driver, and Ben Affleck.
Ooh.
And it is because of that lineup that I went to see a 14th century France historical epic based on a true story kind of film. Not traditionally my favorite genre, but that cast I could not resist. Plus, Ridley Scott as the director, you know, no stranger to epics. So I decided I was going to venture into the theater for this one. And I'll tell you, the cast does not disappoint. So Damon Driver and Affleck, but also the female lead, Jodie Comer, is really, really good as well.
Do we know her?
She's on TV related. She's on some of the TV stuff that I haven't seen. Other people seem to be familiar with her, so I need to check out her her repertoire, but she's very good, but I mean, she doesn't have the name recognition in film.
They couldn't afford a fourth name.
Damon Driver and Affleck. But I think they found the right, they did find the right type of person for this particular role, and it was still, there's parts of it that are still very bloody, very brutal, but essentially the way, this is based on true events, so if you were around in Paris in the 1300s, you might have actually witnessed some of this going on. But the story is really about France's last sanctioned duel, and it was between these friends-turned-bitter enemies, Jean Le Carrouge, played by Matt Damon, and Jacques Legris, played by Adam Driver. And basically, you're told that Legris raped Carrouge's wife, Marguerite, and while he was out of town. And so, against all odds, Marguerite, who is treated like property in this particular era, refuses to stay silent about this brutal attack, and she tells her husband what happened. And he's no saint, but he does appear to sort of support her and agree to take, you know, the charge to the king and try and get justice. And of course, you know, the courts were like, I don't know, this, the other dude says it was consensual and pleasurable for both. And so your only recourse now is, hey, Carouge, if you want to challenge Legree to a duel to the death, then, you know, hey, go for that. And so that's what happens. But what really makes the story unique and kind of the movie unique and kind of long is that it takes the same time frame and shows you the same time three times. So you're seeing that same time frame from the different perspectives.
Rashomon already did
of
that.
Of the three. So you see the perspective and the female perspective. So Matt Damon and Ben Affleck actually wrote two of the parts. And then Nicole Holofcener, who wrote Can You Ever Forgive Me, wrote the part of Marguerite. So it does have a true female perspective. And that too, it was written by. But yeah, it just all culminates, though, the three different perspectives on what exactly happened and whether it was rape is told three times, and then it culminates in the duel, and then the duel is just a gruel, and it goes on, and the idea is that it's up to God to decide now who is telling the truth. And if Carouge and, you know, Marguerite are on the side of right, then Legree will perish in this duel. But then there's some twists to the fate of all three and what could happen if things went a certain way. So definitely, you know, the violence and having to relive certain scenes multiple times that were kind of uncomfortable, that was a little rough over 2.5 hours, but the cast is just so solid and the direction is good. It's the same director as Gladiator, and so you get that vibe when they're in, you know, having this duel with all the spectators there. I think it's going to probably rack up a few Oscar noms along the way for, you know, maybe for like direction or for the set, the costumes and all of that, because it is it's an epic. And so there are parts of this to like, but you have to really be okay with the brutal violence that is a part of this story. But it is a Me Too story set in the 14th century.
So the last, I guess you'd say, the state-sanctioned duel in France is in the 14th century, and we've got Aaron Burr killing Alexander Hamilton in the early 19th century. I mean, we're always behind Europe.
No, but this is a duel that was like in the arena with all these people cheering on and watching, and the king. So it was like it was sport.
Well,
it was
total
sport.
Amusing, and I think that's the correct word. Amusing. It's like it's so gory, it's so bloody. No, it's not. Halloween Kills.
That's gory.
Is gory. Moving on, because actually I don't have anything to add to the last two. I haven't seen it.
Yeah.
I haven't heard any Oscar buzz. You're the first and only person I've heard say
only,
Oscar.
No, for some of those those smaller types
like,
of things,
like best director.
No, but not necessarily best director. I'm saying for those smaller things about. You know how like Tenet made it in with one nomination last year, even though nobody saw it and liked it, but there were some visual aspects to it that everybody oohed and aahed about.
Yeah, it's because it was very visually
right. Effective. And so I'm saying that I do think with costumes and things like that, that it could make it in there.
All right, since I know all of you out there have Peacock on streaming, you've all signed up for Peacock. You don't have to go to the theaters to see Halloween Kills. You can just turn on Peacock.
Although they want you to go to the theaters
they
to
do.
See Halloween.
And they also want you to sign up for Peacock, which none of you are going to do either. Directed by David Gordon Green. He also directed the 2018 reboot. This is the second film in a planned trilogy. The third one is supposed to come out Halloween of next year.
Mm-hmm.
Halloween Ends. And thank God.
So So I have a year to watch this one.
And I don't think you should.
Okay.
Even though this is the 12th film in the franchise. Remember, 2018 erased the 10 before it and was the direct sequel to the 1978 one that introduced all of us to Jamie Lee Curtis. This was, you know, 40 years later, Michael's still going. Well, remember 2018, we thought she locked him in the basement. He was going to burn up in a fire.
Yeah.
Do you think he did, Hannah? Do you think he did?
Gee, I don't know. Did he not burn up in that fire? I know I left the theater in 2018 thinking he'd burned up in the fire.
Yeah.
Hoping he had burned up in the fire.
Well, it turns out, not this time. No, he's back. And it picks up immediately afterward. The sequel is immediately the next, like, 20 minutes later. And it all takes place that same very night. Jamie Lee Curtis spends the entire film in the hospital. Remember, she got a good stabbing at the end of that film. So she's barely in the film. She's barely in it. She's in the hospital and she does some speechifying. And what they do, the twist is, they bring back some of the characters from 78. They even bring back the adults who played them as kids. Little Lindsay, little Tommy. Remember, their babysitters were annihilated. He didn't want to be a babysitter in 1978 Halloween. But the kids, they're back. Lindsay's not played by the real adult Lindsay. But Tommy's not. Tommy's Anthony Michael Hall. You remember him? Oh, Breakfast Club, mm-hmm. 16 Candles. He's the one saying, he's going to stir up the masses. Hey, this is our town. This guy's on the loose. And he creates a mob. Like, the mob takes over the hospital and they're all screaming, evil must die, evil must die. And it's terrible. It's the worst screenplay of the year. It's so bad. And shame on you, Anthony Michael Hall, for doing that. Paul Rudd played Tommy in 95's Halloween: The Curse of Michael Myers. How much better would this have been if they brought Paul Rudd back?
Oh, I thought
that?
Maybe they did, but they did not.
They did not.
Oh.
Now, I'm sure he was busy or whatever, but no, they didn't. Judy Greer's back.
Or he read the script.
Yeah, he was probably like, I'm Paul Rudd. I can't do this. Judy Greer's back as the daughter. Andy Maciak is back as the granddaughter, and they're still running around screaming, no, Mom, you're hurt. You got to lay down. We'll go kill Michael. We'll kill him. We'll kill him for you. Extra gory. Much blood. God-awful screenplay. Atrocious acting. Just atrocious. It's terrible. They do, all right, strength in numbers. Strength in number. He can't overpower all of us. And what's the next thing they do? They split up. They split up. If there's a noise upstairs and you know there's a bad guy in your house, they go upstairs, Hannah.
That's
they
never,
go upstairs.
Never a good idea.
Like, multiple of them. They go upstairs. They don't come back downstairs. What an idiot. Worst. I don't know if it's the worst one ever. There's been some really bad Halloween films. But, nobody go watch this. Nobody watch Halloween Kills. They're placeholding. Like, they leave it on a little speech cliffhanger. Like, you can tell the last one's coming. It's so bad.
Wow. And that's interesting. I kind of suspected as much because we were supposed to get access to it a lot earlier than we did. So I did not have a chance to watch. And I heard absolutely nothing to indicate that I should be watching it. I don't like horror. And so to know that Jamie Lee Curtis is actually minimized her role in this particular film, that's the only reason that I went to the last one and that I was thinking maybe I would watch this. But it's just not of interest to me, and hearing that it sucks just makes me know that I made the right call with not bothering to watch. But I'm glad that between the two of us, we saw the two biggest films coming out this week, because there are those horror buffs that no matter what we say are going to watch this Halloween.
And they're probably going to defend it. Oh, yeah. He's back. It's classic. He's killing.
It's a means to an end
history
with the trilogy.
Repeating.
History repeating, just like the beer says.
Now, one we did watch the same. We actually do share a film in this episode. Bergman Island. Mia Hansen-Love directing. I've seen two of her previous films. 2016's Things to Come, starring Isabelle Huppert. And 2014's Eden. Starring Tim Roth and Vicky Creeps. I just saw her in Old, M. Night mm-hmm. Shyamalan's yeah. Old. They're Chris and Tony. They're both directors, and they go to Faroe Island in Sweden, which is Ingmar Bergman's stomping grounds. He went there to make a movie and never left. Lived there for like 50 years, something, some hardcore thing. So they go stay in his old house. They want inspiration. They're both writing screenplays, and Tony's good. Right. Direct. I know what's up. I'm here. Let's work.
Well, he's the accomplished. He's the more accomplished, high profile of the two in his filmmaking work.
Chris is a bit more meandering. She has an idea, She can't put it on paper. And even though it's calm and idyllic, she's just distracted. She says it feels oppressive. How art film can you get? Looks good. I would like to go to that island. You know, you could take the Bergman Safari. You can watch a film in his screening room. I think you do, to get anything or get more out of the film, you have to be familiar with who Ingmar Bergman is, mm-hmm. his legacy in cinema, and what he was about. You don't have to have seen all, like, 50 of his films, but I think you at least should have seen Through a Glass Darkly, Cries and Whispers, and Scenes from a Marriage, especially Scenes from a Marriage, because they actually reference, you know, everyone divorced after that movie, and this is the bed that was in that movie, and they're sleeping in that bed, and... You know, hint, hint, are they talking about this couple as a Bergman couple? Break, break. Film within a film. Mm-hmm. Film within a film. Part A, Part B. What, Hannah, is going on in Part B?
Well, Part B, I'm not 100% sure because I kind of drifted off a little bit with this particular part of it. It's this whole movie within a movie. I'm like, wait a minute. So this is kind of her screenplay where suddenly you've got this other guy and this other... gal who are in essence the leads in this screenplay that she has written and is talking about. And so yes, you end up with this film within a film, and it's a relationship movie. You do absolutely, I am not familiar with Bergman and with Bergman's films to that extent, so I could not appreciate a lot of the references, but this film to me was just oozing with pretension, and Mia Wasikowska. Is sort of the other part of the other couple that is in the movie within the movie, but it sort of all comes back to the same place where it started, and it just did not really, it didn't move me. I just didn't particularly like any of these people enough to care about their story. And I do feel that if I was a Bergman fan, I would have gotten a lot more out of it. So it is strictly an art house film, and I don't think that the masses would really go for it.
I liked this film way, way more than you did. I think it's open to interpretation. Is Amy, the Mia Wasikowska character in the film within the film, is that supposed to be Chris? Is that her alter ego?
Right, that's what, right.
Is her relationship with Joseph mirroring her relationship with Tony, or is it just a story? Where does reality stop and that film start? Because at the end, Mia Hansen Love starts playing with you a little bit. She rips the rug out from under you in, I think, a very intrepid and fun way. I was having fun at the end, like, oh, what's she going to do to me next? There's an excellent use of ABBA. We're in Sweden, and we're talking about Bergman, so which is kind of the antithesis of ABBA. The Winner Takes It All has a great sequence in there. This was originally not supposed to be Vicky Creeps and Tim Roth. This was supposed to be Greta Gerwig and John Turturro.
Oh, I can totally see that too, though.
And then Turturro dropped out, so it was supposed to be Greta Gerwig and Owen Wilson.
Oh,
and
wow.
Wilson dropped out right before filming. So they filmed half this movie without a leading man, and they brought Tim Roth on like at the very end to film those scenes.
Huh.
So the way it is now was just not how it was dreamed to be. I think it turned out great. Tim Roth is just fine.
He is good.
Christian, talking to you here, buddy. Christian Hammaker, who this film is for. It's for movie lovers. It's for cinephiles. And you do, I mean, you don't have to be a Bergman completist. You do not have to be an expert. You just have to be knowledgeable of.
Yes, but you do have to be more of an, you have to be arty leaning versus mainstream leaning to like the film on the level that you do. Because there are levels of pretension in this film, and it is meant to, you know, oh, if you don't get it, you don't get it. And so
now there are, and I think this film skewers viewers like that. They actually, you know, there's like a little, not a film festival in it, but there's like a film screening, and Chris is having none of it. She's like, I don't want to be around those people. And, you know, they're viewing Tony's film, so he's all about it. But she just disappears. She doesn't want anything to do with him. So I think at one point, you know, this is the director saying, I don't like those cinephiles either. Those pretentious cinephiles.
Yeah,
so while it might, there are pretentious people in it, I don't think it's a pretentious film.
And I think it's a combination. So I think there are elements of it that I found to be very pretentious. In some cases, they are sort of mocking the pretentious group, the film society types and the ones who were drawn to the artier film festivals. But so I liked bits and pieces of it. The scenery is gorgeous. I absolutely am ready to go to this island. But
you're not going to go to the island to go to the screening room.
No, not at all. I'm going to go do what Chris did and hang out at the beach and just sort of take in other aspects of the island. But so you liked it way more than I did. I think it's a fine art house film, but it is a film for cinephiles.
Yeah, I agree. But I do not agree on the pretension. So you actually veered away a little bit from the mainstream this week. You went for another art house film. Now I'm only saying art house because it's only going to play art house theaters, but it's more of a I looked at the trailer. It looks like a Western noir.
So I was supposed to watch Hard Luck Love Song as part of the Nashville Film Festival, because it was playing there.
How pretentious of you. You film festival
and
type
I didn't.
You.
I didn't make it. But so then I thought, it's a romantic drama. I'll country music, I'll listen. I'll watch. Well, it is a gritty romantic drama with the emphasis on gritty.
It's not your type. You don't like gritty.
No. But you talk about movies that are based on... we joke sometimes about how movies like Pirates of the Caribbean, things that can be based on a ride, Jurassic Park. If Disney can make a movie based on rides, then movies like Hard Luck Love Song can be made because it is an indie inspired by a song. So the whole film is inspired by a song called Just Like Old Times by singer-songwriter Todd Snyder. It's a woeful country western song and it's a woeful movie. It follows Jesse, played by Michael Dorman, and he is just this charismatic loser who is just kind of always getting himself into trouble. He's his own worst enemy. He's always getting beaten up, and he's a singer songwriter type, and just wants to make his career, in Nashville or as a country star, as a country singer. But he just can't get there because it turns out he's also like a drug addict. And he ends up getting back together with his old flame, Carla, played by Sophia Bush. And they have this very toxic past. And so them getting back together, you're just not so sure that's such a wise move. And he gets beaten up again. And
sounds like a country song.
And yeah. And then it's like, are they okay for each other? Can they save each other? I don't know.
And do you care?
And so... You care a little bit by the end because you just sort of you root for this pair, even though they're totally dysfunctional and probably bad for each other. I wanted to like this film a lot more than I did. It was too gritty, and I really was like, I was not anticipating it being more of this heavy character study versus a romantic drama. So when they call it a romantic drama, it's a gritty romantic drama, and I'm sorry, but gritty takes precedence over everything else that happens in this film. But I love the song, and they I think they played the song over the guy performing the song over the end credits, and so I was like, oh, this is the song, and they made a whole movie.
That's like your second end credit song in a row. Remember you mentioned the same thing about Old Henry like 2 weeks ago.
Yeah. So I've been paying more attention. It is interesting to actually be absorbed to sit through an end credit role because you do like what they've chosen to play.
So it's not like Mamma Mia. That was built around songs.
Yeah. No, no. This is more built. Was it Old Henry, the one that we saw that just had, that was kind of gritty?
It was very gritty, but that wasn't a romantic drama.
Right, but it was
that
same.
That was a Western.
Right, but this was almost kind of like a contemporary spin on taking a country song and just making this rather dark film. So it wasn't fun. I wanted fun, and it's not fun.
Well, then I would rather them make a movie out of the song, I Want to Check You for Ticks. That's a rom-com waiting to happen.
But it's not Mama. It's just not a Mamma Mia style. It's really just truly like anything else. It's, this was based on true events, or this was inspired by some other story. This is just inspired by the song. Like somebody just listened to this woeful song about this
whatever inspires you,
trying to get back with the girl.
If that produces a screenplay, I'm not going to judge you. Whatever works.
But so again, it's an art house romantic drama.
Of course
so,
it is.
There's just been a lot of art house leaning stuff.
Well, while you have to watch all rom coms and all romantic dramedies and even gritty romantic dramas, I have to watch all music documentaries.
I love most music documentaries.
And I believe you shut this one off 10 to 15 minutes in.
Indeed.
I made it all the way through the very long 2 hours of The Velvet Underground, brought to you by Todd Haynes, who's not known as a feature documentary filmmaker. This guy, you know, he made Carol, a wonderful film. Remember Kate Blanchett?
Yeah,
Rooney Mara was a wonderful film. He made Far From Heaven, Julianne Moore. Mm-hmm. He did I'm Not There, known as the anti-biopic, about the kind of Bob Dylan. So apparently The Velvet Underground must be Todd Haynes' favorite band, and it's a challenge. This is not your standard.
Yeah.
This is not your standard musical biography of here's the guys, here's how they came together. Here's all the albums they made, and this is why they broke up or died or whatever. This is not that. This is a split-screen, like, Warhol multimedia technique extravaganza in your face. There's a lot to look at, and it can be very distracting. The arc you're familiar with is just not there. There's no narrator, and it assumes you already know who they are.
Mm-hmm.
You had better know The Velvet Underground before you watch this. This is not an intro class. This is not a 101.
Mm-mm.
I think you need to know Lou Reed's legacy as a solo artist. You need to know Andy Warhol. You need to know The Factory. And you need to know what all that means before you even open the door to go in and sit down and watch this. There are interviews. The surviving members, John Cale and Maureen Tucker, are here. We get interviews with Jackson Browne. John Waters shows up, Jonathan Richman, you know, the Modern Lovers, he shows up, and there's the voice of David Bowie is even in there. So this must have been in production for a while. It explores New York's avant-garde scene, and I love how they kind of contrast it with the easygoing flower children of California. Maureen even says, we hated those hippies. We hate hippies. And they just had nothing to do with that California scene because they were just, you know, they were Warhol New Yorkians. It's such a small slice of people you recommend this to. Mm-hmm. Okay, if you like The Velvet Underground, go watch this.
And you have Apple TV Plus.
But even then, even if you like The Velvet Underground, like there are certain songs I like Waiting for the Man. I don't want to sit down and listen to White Light, White Heat or Loaded. I mean, The Velvet Underground's even a little bit too experimental for me. But some people just really, they were not that popular. They were not that popular. They gained popularity after they broke up. And I really think they gained popularity because Warhol nostalgia and Lou Reed's later work made people rediscover what the Velvet Underground were doing. It's still, a lot of it still sounds like Feedback mess. So it's honestly a rough watch.
Yeah, I just couldn't stay with it. And I realized, why am I bothering? Because I think Velvet Underground ended up with, you know, very much of a cult following. And if you're part of that cult, then you will find some value in watching this. But yeah, if you're not familiar with the Velvet Underground and Lou Reed, you are not going to get anything out of 2 hours of watching this. So whereas Bergman Island, I could still find things to appreciate about the film, even though I didn't really know enough about Bergman himself. The Velvet Underground does not work if you do not know the Velvet Underground.
Hear, hear. And I knew enough, but even then I was struggling. I have some odds and ends.
Well, I have one more documentary that I watched instead of yours.
Oh, that's right.
I watched one called The Rescue because I really do like those based on those true stories that were in the news, you know, the sort of ripped from the headlines.
And everybody remembers this.
Everybody remembers the rescue in 2018 of 12 boys and their soccer coach from deep inside a watery cave in northern Thailand. Every news outlet from around the world was there, and people were watching and waiting to see what would happen. And I learned a lot watching The Rescue, and it was from the filmmakers behind Free Solo. So it definitely knows how to create some drama and tension. And it just sheds all this new light on just this high-risk world of cave diving and the people, the rare group of people, like from London, that came to Thailand to really lead what became the rescue. And it was kind of fascinating because they were these very less than buff weekend warriors who ended up showing up the Thailand Navy SEALs because the Navy SEALs did not know how to do cave diving. They had done all sorts of other rescue, but this was just not something that they knew how to navigate. So you had these guys come in and basically be like, leave it to us. And they find them, and there's the footage that they had actually, you know, when they came across the boys and their coach in this tunnel and in this cave and realizing that it was still going to take a tremendous operation to get them out and that it would take days even after they were found. It was just very intriguing. And so if you like those documentaries where you really get more of the story that, you know, that you just kind of didn't get, it's a little bit reminiscent of like that the 33, the miners that were rescued. Kind of has a little bit of that vibe. But you learn about how the gamble that they took in sedating the kids to bring them out, to put scuba gear on them and to bring them out when they were sedated, and how tough that decision was. And if something had gone wrong and if any of those kids had actually had died, we'd be watching an episode of Locked Up Abroad right now. Like, these guys would have probably been brought up on charges for taking this risk and letting these kids die. When in fact, you know, they figured out they took a risk that was the only risk. It was the only thing they could do. And fortunately, it paid off. And so even when you know how it ends, it's still very interesting to watch, because the boys weren't missing. They were trapped. And it was all about how you find these kids and then how in the world do we get them out one by one alive.
It does sound like a worthwhile watch. I do hope. Actually, I think I want to take the kid to see it. I think it would be up his wheelhouse. Speaking of the kid, we watched a documentary, and it's brand new on Hulu, even though I remember it was in theaters, and it's called The Loneliest Whale. It's a whale out there that the Navy first heard back in a long time ago. I don't remember exactly. I think it was like 2004, maybe. And they heard this whale singing on a frequency that no other whales could hear or respond to. He's on his own frequency. And so since they've only heard this one whale do that on this one frequency, like, oh, it must be the loneliest whale. And it went viral, and everyone like, oh, they wrote poems about it, and they blew up social media. And this is a documentary about how some guys tried to secure some funding to go find the loneliest whale. What kind of whale is it? Where is he? Is he still alive? Can we find this whale? Leonardo DiCaprio cared. He executive produced it. Adrian Grenier, remember Vincent Chase on Entourage? There's a million executive producers, but I saw those two names pop up on the screen. And the kid got excited about whales. So good for kids. Adults are like, oh, yeah, whales. That's cool. Hope he's not too lonely. Pokemon the movie, Secrets of the Jungle. I went through that one. Let's not talk about that.
Okay.
Last week, we talked about Squid Game. Mm-hmm. And how it was blowing up the entire world. Well, I did it. I haven't finished it, but I've watched 6 hours.
Oh my goodness!
Of Squid Game.
No wonder you didn't watch any of these other things.
I watched 6 hours, and I still have 3 hours to go. I don't know. So it is the most popular, I guess, Netflix show ever.
Ever.
Mm-hmm. It's got North Korea's attention. They're using it for score propaganda points. I don't get the mania. I understand why it's popular. It is engaging. You want to find out what happens next, what game is next, who's it going to be, who's going to die. But why are folks losing their mind over this? I can't tell you. Some people are saying, well, it's South Korea's cultural influence. It's Hollywood doesn't make these stories, so people are going elsewhere for them. Or it's the masses need them some Hunger Games.
Or it's groupthink, and people are like, word of mouth managing.
Maybe it is. I don't know why it's this show is like number one. It's fine, as Hannah would say. It's okay.
Yeah.
I've seen way worse shows. I've seen better shows. It's not great.
But at least it takes over from like the Tiger King at the beginning of the pandemic.
I watched one episode of.
And I saw that one all the way through. And so with this one, it's just not an appealing topic to me. So I just haven't, you know, really indulged because I'm not sure I'd want to watch all of them. And it does seem like the kind of show you would absolutely need to watch the whole entire season.
Yeah, you want to know what happens. Who's, you know, who's going to live? Is anyone going to live? I have my suspicions about what's going to happen. But,
Well, and I do think, I failed to mention The Rescue is a Nat Geo film. Mm-hmm. And so I suspect we'll eventually that one will be available on the Nat Geo channel at some point. But yeah, so it's just interesting what choices people are making if they're not going into a theater. You know, we no longer have Ted Lasso to talk about, and for you know that won't be out for another year the next season. And so I do think that some of these things that pre-pandemic would not have not necessarily have found that kind of audience are able to find an audience, and people are looking for what they can watch from home. And so we'll see if anybody goes into the theaters this weekend for Halloween and The Last Duel.
Well, big big theaters next week, Dune and The French Dispatch.
And we will miss it. I will be missing both because I will be on vacation. But that brings us to an announcement of sorts, I would say, Charlie.
Yeah, the Cinema Clash is coming to, I guess the appropriate word is an end, or at least a big, a change.
A very big hiatus, perhaps.
Yeah, Hannah's promised that we'll go through the end of the calendar year, probably maybe do a top 10 list like we've done, but we're no longer going to do a weekly show.
Yeah.
Things are changing.
Things are changing. We had, I think we've been doing this about 6 years or so, at least. You only had one kid when we started, and your second kid's about the age that your first one was when we started. So we definitely have been doing this a long time, and yes, things have been shifting in the COVID era and with our personal and professional lives, and so it just becomes a little more difficult to try and crank this out every week, But yeah, so it's bittersweet. But so we wanted to give everybody a little bit of a heads up. Feel free to tweet us or you know how to contact us by now, and we'll try and keep it going through the end of the year with you know with a few key weeks of movie watching when hopefully we can both see some of the same things, and who knows? I never say never after all these. Getting the band back together, you know, documentaries that we've been watching over the past 7 years. Maybe we can just have a reunion special around Oscar time so that those who count on our Oscar predictions can sort of have that to leverage for the Oscar pool.
Yeah, we should do an Oscar cast. I guarantee you, if you listen to our Oscar episode, you will win your Oscar pool. I still will lay down money on that. And I also lay down money that the best film of this week is Bergman Island. You should go see Bergman Island.
No. I'd say if you're going to go into a theater, then The Rescue is probably the coolest thing to watch because you're just going to be literally immersed in this true story. And The Last Duel will be of interest. Will be just if you like the historical epic films, if you like a gladiator kind of film, then The Last Duel is the one that you should watch. Obviously, over Halloween, it sounds like nobody should be that any one of these other films, even The Velvet Underground, perhaps should top your list before Halloween. But yeah,
that's saying something.
So we will keep it going through the end of the year as best we can, and hope all of our listeners can give us feedback as possible, and hopefully, you know, we'll be back, to quote the Terminator.
Wow. All right. Well, thank you very much for listening to this episode of The Cinema Clash. I am Charlie Jewell.
I'm Hannah Buchdahl.
Thank you.
Take care.
The Cinema Clash with Charlie Jewell and Hannah Buchdahl is heard twice each weekend. At 5:15 on Saturday and 12:15 on Sunday afternoon. Join us again next time for The Cinema Clash.